Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So, NHL season officially wraps up last night. Stanley Cup final is done, and that means a lot of things, but two things specifically for our purposes right here. One is that the buyout window opens on Thursday, officially 48 hours
for three days.
For 3 days. Yeah.
It's like the shortest buyout window ever.
It's a really quick buyout window, so we'll see what goes on in the buyout window.
And it's technically the first buyout window,
that's right,
Jamie.
Because the other one is if you have an arbitration award against you. Yeah.
Yeah, it opens team specific.
That's right. The first league-wide buyout window opens on Thursday. The other thing is that I know this is a highlight of the NHL calendar for you, is that
once the Stanley Cup
is awarded, future odds for next season's Stanley Cup winner are released very, very quickly.
Yeah. So, look, I'm a big fan of futures because they just, it's an objective snapshot set by sharp handicappers of precisely where a team lies, right? And what I like about looking at it when the offseason, or when after the cup is awarded, is that the offseason now is like officially begun, right? The Canucks are now, the NHL itself is now in offseason mode. The league year will end in 6 days and a new one will begin.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to start to see moves happen, which are going to shift these odds. So this is like a baseline, right, that we can operate from, and moves over the course of the summer and then actual real-time results in addition to injuries and other news will impact it all the way up until the moment the cup is awarded in real time. And that market will be adjusted by handicappers, but also set and adjusted in real time based on real money wagers from, you know, hockey fans, like sharp hockey fans. It's almost like a collective, it's a dynamic market, right? That is shaped by a variety of things, including like public teams,
yep,
but also by like effectively the collective opinion backed up by hard cash of betting hockey fans across the world. I always will think that's worth paying attention to, but also, you know, putting into its proper context that, you know, the Leafs being 16-1 or whatever, right, needs to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt because
public team context. Yeah.
And the Rangers being 12-1, right? Maybe if the Rangers played on Long Island, would they be 20-1? If the Leafs played in Ottawa, would they be 22-1? I mean, it's worth taking with a grain of salt. But I still think it's instructive and worth paying attention to. So, can I do the rundown?
Please.
Per one of the major American sports books, and of course, we'll always suggest that you go to play now. The Florida Panthers and the Dallas Stars open as co-favorites. 9-1 odds, plus 900. The Edmonton Oilers, 9.5. They're the third favorite. And then there's a tier of three teams, the Rangers, the Avalanche, and the Hurricanes, all at 12-1. Okay? We then get to the Devils at 13-1. Pretty interesting. They made the Markstrom trade.
Yep.
But they also had a nightmare season and surrendered the first goal like in the opening 5 minutes almost every game they played all year. So I find that fascinating, just in general. Then you get to a tier of two, the Golden Knights and the Toronto Maple Leafs. So at this point, we have name-checked 9 teams. And this is where we get to the Vancouver Canucks. The Vancouver Canucks find themselves in a tier of three, along with the Boston Bruins and the Winnipeg Jets at 20-1, followed by the LA Kings at 22-1, the Tampa Bay Lightning at 25-1, the Ottawa Senators, presumably helping their stock with the Allmark trade, at 35-1, Nashville and Detroit also at 35-1. St. Louis, Pittsburgh, the Islanders, and the Buffalo Sabres all come in at 40-1, and then there's a bunch of other teams. The Wild at 45-1 seems pretty low.
Yeah, I don't get Ottawa over the Wild. Explain that to me.
I think it's just the upside case of like, if their talent hits, you could see them leveling up quick. And I think that's why Buffalo gets the respect that they do, too.
Sure.
So, here's the associated odds that I think are necessary to pay attention to in understanding a relatively healthy level of respect, right? I mean, the Canucks are...
That was my reaction. And I think
in the top 12. They're not in the top 10 because there's nothing
separating
them.
They're tied for 10th.
Tied for 10th. But so they're in the top 12. And I think that's roughly right, right? Like, fringes of the top 10, top 12, I think that's roughly where this team landed with how they upgraded their defensive game over the course of the season. Like, I think they were somewhere in that mix where, you know, they weren't really a contender level team, but they were on the fringes. And, you know, there's an upside case to be made for them.
And I think the context is the reason I kind of my first blush reaction was, oh, that's a lot of respect for the Canucks, was because they do have so much uncertainty going into the summer and so much work to do. But I think what it reflects is a pretty high level of confidence in what will still be here.
Right.
And then if they can take that next jump, it's going to depend on what they do around the fringes. But it's basically them saying Demko, Hughes, Miller, Pettersson, Besser, Hronek gets you to this level. To get above that, you need to do a really good job of filling out the rest of the roster.
The thing, though, is like the Devils have higher odds than them, and they have a wild amount of uncertainty. Go check how many contracts the Hurricanes have. They're 12-1, right? The Winnipeg Jets, who are tied with the Canucks, I mean, we don't know where Nikolaj Ehlers is playing next year. The Toronto Maple Leafs, who are ahead of the Canucks, we don't know where Mitch Marner is playing next year, and we don't know what their goaltending situation is aside from Joseph Woll, who's frequently hurt but super talented. So here's the odds. Here's the other market that is opened that I think you got to pay attention to in understanding the Canucks' perch. This is Vezina Trophy Futures for the 2024-25 season from a prominent American sports book. Jeremy Swayman, plus 600, is the favorite at opening. Igor Shesterkin is a co-favorite, plus 600. Thatcher Demko comes third, plus 800. And then Sorokin and Connor Hellebuck, plus 1,000. So the Jets, the Bruins, the Canucks are all sort of bundled together in this 20-1 tier for the futures market. And what I'd probably suggest to you, Jamie, is more than respect for the Canucks core, what I think their Stanley Cup outright opening number tells you is that there's a lot of respect from bettors for Thatcher Demko. That, like, there's at least an upside case at 20-1 where Demko goes on a heater at the right time of year and you're able to snag, steal, scrape your way to a Stanley Cup, much like the Boston Bruins could with Swayman, much like the Winnipeg Jets could with Connor Hellebuck, all of them top five odds. Now, you know, it's not enough for the Islanders to be better than 40-1, but you have to be at a certain level, right? That said, the markets differentiate the Rangers at 12-1, the fourth best odds, from Boston, you know, Vancouver and Winnipeg, the teams with star level starters or starters who you could see
winning the
steamrolling
through.
By the way, Cale Makar opens as the Norris favorite, plus 250. Quinn Hughes in second, tied with Miro Heiskanen, Evan Bouchard and Adam Fox at plus 800. It's super hard to repeat as Norris, and I, you know, the markets think that Hughes is basically a shoe-in this week, so I'd say that's probably partly
it is now.
What's priced in.
It used to not be at all. It used to be like one guy would win the Norris for like 4 years in a row,
totally.
Repeatedly, right? And which I think actually makes sense. I think we've gotten away from that, but almost we should go back to it.
Yeah,
with some exceptions, but like Nick Lidstrom won it a lot, you know, in the row.
Sure.
Ray Bourque, obviously Bobby Orr. Like, it used to be like, yeah, you're the best defenseman in the league.
Yeah,
here's
I mean,
your consecutive Norrises.
Lidstrom won it 3 years in a row, 2006, 2007, 2008. And no one has repeated
has gone
since.
Back to back. Yeah.
But I mean, Lidstrom also won it 6 of 7 years it was awarded. My God. And actually, it's 7 of 9. What a freak.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
That dude is unreal.
Hart Trophy odds, by the way.
Connor McDavid, number one.
Well, yeah. And by
nailed
a lot.
It.
Plus 175. Next, second closest is Nathan MacKinnon, plus 700. So, I mean, McDavid winning the Hart is... you're not getting good odds on that. Quinn Hughes is the leading Canuck at plus 5,000, so 50-1. And there's only about 12, 13 names ahead of him. One of them, though, is Connor Bedard.
Oh, wow.
And then Elias Pettersson at plus at 60-1. JT Miller. JT Miller at 150-1. So anyway, just coming back to this. I think what the Canucks opening spot in these outrights tells you is the market views them as a team with enough upside to like legitimately threaten the books that they could actually win the cup. but I think it's their grouping with Boston and Winnipeg, I still think reflects the uncertainty. Like, I think that uncertainty that you're talking about with the roster is, like, very much priced in. It's like, we don't know that the team necessarily is at the level of a contender, but we think the goalie is good enough to upset the apple cart. And we're not going to give people, like, 35-1 odds if Demko can just, like, steal our money. So we're gonna price them conservatively. And so what does an offseason that answers some of our looming questions look like? Well, I think it gets them to 12-1, right? Like, the Rangers are kind of where you'd be looking to get to if you can level up your roster to the point where that's actually getting respect, not just the fact that you have, like, a good enough team, but the star goalie.
That's my read on it. I think it's fair. I think it's I would struggle to take, like, a strong issue either way. Like, oh, they should be have way better odds than that, or they should be way farther down the list. Like, it seems to be right in the right spot for them, which is no surprise. That's what the odds makers do, right?
Or I think a right spot for them going into the season.
Sure, right? With the uncertainty baked in, right? Yeah. Obviously, what they do in the summer could change them either way, right? If they have a disappointing or if they have a really successful summer. But I think with the uncertainty baked in, but also the upside of Demko and Hughes and Patterson and Miller, I think they're right in the right spot there in those rankings.
But I do think the upside case of Demko is enough that they're not, like, the markets might hate their offseason.
No,
they're
not going to drop down to, like, the Ottawa tier.
No.
Yeah, because you have that Demko factor. Okay, 650. I mentioned the buyout window opening on Thursday as well. Justin texted in earlier. We haven't really touched on this, but he says, a year later, what are your guys' thoughts on the Oliver Ekman-Larsson buyout? And my thought is, if anything, significantly more positive that they did it. And I know there's this, like, Canucks fan thing where it's like, ah, we're still paying him, and he goes and he wins the Stanley Cup for Florida. And I mean, he was on their power play one for the last couple of games of the series. But that has no bearing on the Canucks' decision to buy him out. What's he making? Like $3.25 million in Florida? If they could have had Oliver Ekman-Larsson on a short-term $2.25 million deal, that would have been a home run.
Playing third pair minutes.
But there was no universe when that was going to happen. And then you think about the cap space they saved by buying him out and what they did with that and the season they had as a result. I don't think any Canucks fan whatsoever should be looking at this and saying, like, oh, man, like, typical Canucks. They buy this guy out and he goes and has success. What Oliver Ekman-Larsson did in Florida has no bearing on the Canucks' decision to buy him out, which was 100% the correct call and looks even better now than it did a year ago when they made the decision.
Yeah, because they put the money to good use. I mean, there was, like, a sense after the buyout was executed that the Canucks had, you know, done something genius as opposed to something that's just built in to every standard player contract you sign, right? Like, every contract is eligible to be bought out. You know, the point is not to buy a deal out. The point is to make that buyout worth it, right? Do the associated moves, use that cap space efficiently enough, take advantage of the flexibility gained so that your team is better off for having made that decision. And certainly in the first year, which is the year where the savings were really targeted to, right? Like, you know, going forward for the next few years, I mean, there's still savings, cap savings, but those cap savings will diminish, right? Like, the cap hit will rise in terms of what the Canucks have to pay, how much dead money there is on their books, what they have to navigate around. And, you know, the test will still ultimately come. But when you exercise the buyout and then go out and win 50 games and win your division and make it to the second round of the playoffs and excite a market that had been, you know, I think made pretty cynical and fatalistic by the club's struggles over the course of the past decade, I mean, that you're off to a very good start in terms of the buyout. Now, I do still think it's important. Like, I think you're right that the buyout looks better today than it did the day they exercised it because of the hay they made in the first year of it. But I also don't think we should ignore the difficulty that the club's going to face. Not this season. I mean, it goes up to two plus million. But the year after, 4.5. And the year after that, 4.5. And, you know, for example, like, Ilya Mikheyev. So we just saw the Detroit Red Wings have to attach a second to get off Walman, who has the same amount of term, right?
And less money on it, less AAV.
Less AAV, and honestly is probably seen around the league as a more useful contributor, right?
I would think so.
Because Wallman at 3.5.
I think views probably differ a lot on Wallman.
100%.
And he had a tough year. I understand that. But if you were offering me the choice of Jake Wallman on his contract for the next 2 years or Ilya Mikheyev on his, I would take Jake Wallman. And I think that's probably the most popular view around the NHL.
Yeah. And I think you have to look at it, too, in terms of like what the market price is, right? Like if you make $3.4 million, you're valued as a second pair defenseman. And I think teams would probably view Wallman as like a 4-5.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's overpriced, it's not by a ton. Whereas when you make 4.5, right, and you're a forward, you know, the expectations are a little bit higher there. Like you're kind of paid as, you know,
I think 3-4 is like 4-5 money. Really? Hmm? Like 3.4 million is like 4-5 money to me.
In terms of...
For a defenseman? Like, you know what I mean? Like that's, like, I don't think he is overpaid or overvalued. If you think he's a 4-5... And he's making $3.4 million. Well, like, it's not like if you sign a guy to a $3.4 million deal, you're not like he's a mortal lock top four guy, or you're fooling yourself if you are thinking that. You got to pay more than that for a top four guy.
Well, but it's sort of like the free agent impact, right?
Sure.
It's kind of about age. But yeah, I mean, he's like the 90th highest paid defenseman, right? So I guess you're right. That is 4-5 territory.
Yeah.
You know, because you're. Yeah, so that's four. He is paid. You're right. You know what? He is paid as a 4-5. I got the math wrong in my head because it's really 60. Yeah, so he's paid as a high end 4.
Yeah.
And maybe he's a 4-5. So you're overpaying him within the same tier, whereas Mikheyev's like the 120th highest paid forward, and if you went by wingers, right? It's like he's almost more of like a low end top line winger
in terms
of
salary.
High end second line. Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely one of the 60 highest paid wingers in the league. That becomes cumbersome, right? So there's more inefficiency there. They had to attach a pretty significant sweetener to get off that deal. And, you know, this is one of like the costs of the OEL buyout. If you bought out Mikheyev, which usually would be like relatively palatable, the problem is that you'd then have a $7 million. Like the problem is how it compounds with the OEL buyout. So this is just like a small cost, right? Like a small cost of the OEL buyout is that now, you know, in a world where Mikheyev's going to cost a pretty decent sweetener to get off of, the buyout weapon is something that you have to be very reluctant to use because you don't want, like, whatever, you eat the $1.5 million penalty this year, no problem. But the next year, it would make his combined buyout cost with OELs like $7 million in dead space. Well, that's significant.
Yep.
In the last year of Demko's deal. And the year after that, it'd be like $6.25 million in the last year of Hughes's deal. Well, That's money that might hold you back from contending. That's money that if you make it to a Stanley Cup final game 7, that might be the difference, right? In a coin flip game, in a coin flip series that costs you immortality, that costs you the stuff that matters. So, you know, I think that's sort of where the OEL discussion ultimately will keep evolving, but I definitely think a year out, there's no question that the Canucks benefited from making that move and paid off sort of the longer term inflexibility that doing that move will create and that they'll have to navigate around sharply here.
And again, I think the key point is, because you're right, like no one's saying there aren't downsides to buying OEL out. Of course there are, but those are baked in at the time. Those are locked
totally.
In as soon as you do it, right?
Yes.
And I think the key for me is like nothing that Oliver Ekman-Larsson does from here on out affects whether it was a smart decision.
No.
Short of like reemerging as a top
superstar
pair NHL defenseman.
100%.
Right? Nothing he does, or contributing to good teams, anything like that, retroactively makes the decision look worse.
No. It's just that the cap hit from that buyout was $146,000.
Yes. And then it's going to get tougher.
Next year, it's 2.3. The year after that, 4.7, 4.7. So it's like, of course, the year that it's least painful is always going to be the best one. Right? Like it's going to become a weight of some magnitude, right? Maybe that weight will diminish because the cap goes up or what have you. But it's going to be a weight of some magnitude for this franchise to navigate around. And so I do think it's important not to like settle this conversation at any point. You know, like, these are dynamic decisions, and I think our opinion on them is naturally going to ebb and flow and probably should, and we should just leave space for
it. Well, and I think what will change is the evaluation of... Because I think what will always be correct is their decision to give themselves the flexibility, right? But what will change is the evaluation of what they did with the flexibility. And in year one, when they had the most flexibility, and you're right, it's therefore easiest to get the value out of it in some ways, they nailed it. The question is, will they continue to nail it going forward? But
yeah.
But, like, making a bad decision with the salary cap space you inherit doesn't necessarily mean the buyout was bad, right? Like, it's still the right decision to buy him out. You just then have to follow it up with more good decisions. That's
for,
how I would
for sure.
At it.
Well, and, you know, I mean, we'll see how, like, Bluger turns out, right? Like, Bluger was one of the guys they brought in. You still have to be careful about what his next deal looks like, given his age and contributions. You know, like, there's still a lot of ways for this to turn differently. I mean, one thing I'd sort of note, though, is you bring in Soucy. It's been a great fit. Cole, Bluger, Pusuter, right? And you're going to get another year of value. Like, to this point, it's not like the club has turned that cap space into something of significant star-level value. They've just used it well to flesh out a team that improved enough that they were able to, like, get Pettersson done. And so that's significant, right? That's significant. It's a good step. Obviously, a dream campaign. But I do think to really pay it off, you need to keep going here. You need to keep being successful, and you need to keep being sharp, and you need to avoid, you know, using the extra $5 million in space now that you're going to have this year from that buyout. You need to use that $5 million as sharply as you used, you know, the $7 million last season.
All right, we're going to take a break. Final segment of the show coming up, so keep your texts coming in. 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Lots of reports out there, you know, Jake Guentzel reports, signings happening. Things are moving very quickly in the NHL world right now, so we'll talk about all of that. You can send your thoughts and questions in as well. NHL draft coverage is brought to you by Oxygen Yoga and Fitness, not your typical yoga studio. Final segment coming up here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 650, Vancouver.
Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. So just to give everyone a rundown of what the next little bit here looks like for our show, but also just in general, in the NHL. So we had the Hockey Hall of Fame announcement today that we've gone over. As mentioned, buyout window opens on Thursday. So I don't expect the Canucks to be active in the buyout window. We'll see what else happens around the league. We've heard Jeff Skinner's name out there. I am curious, just on the buyout window, how much the rising salary cap affects team's approach to the buyout, right? Because on the one hand, you could look at it and say, well, you know, there's less pressure to move that salary cap now. The cap's going up. But we also know prices are going to go up significantly as well. And we just saw Detroit attach a second-round pick to move a contract that I don't think anyone was looking at as particularly onerous coming into the day. So cap space still could very much be at a premium. I wonder what we'll see in terms of buyouts. We got awards night on Thursday. Of course, expecting Quinn Hughes to win his first Norris, the franchise's first Norris as well. We'll see if that's official on Thursday. The draft Friday and Saturday.
Canucks have no picks on Friday.
Canucks have no picks until the third round.
Yep. So no, but it's Saturday is when the Canucks will have prospects.
It's still the draft, though. And, like, honestly,
it's trade watch. More than anything, it's like red alert trade watch.
It's deal watch more than anything. Yep. From a Canucks perspective, from a league-wide perspective, a qualifying offer deadline for RFAs on Sunday, and then free agency opens Monday.
Qualifying offer deadline.
I know you're excited about it.
It's my favorite day.
Who will hit the open market? Kalen Addison, apparently. The Sharks aren't going to qualify him.
That's an interesting one because that was a Canucks, or that was a Rutherford pick.
Ah.
Right? So yes. That's just an interesting name. I mean, you know my feeling that, like, I do think and I would like to see the Canucks bring in a puck-moving oriented type. Now,
actually, that is an interesting name, just as, like, depth.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, just, like, not you don't bring him in with the highest of hopes. You bring him in to compete with McWard and Juulsen and Friedman for that sixth spot. But I think with Addison, because of the offensive toolkit and the puck moving ability, I think you can look at it too as being like, you know, if you had to play 20 games without Filip Hronek, right? Would he help you secure that impact mm-hmm. that Hronek had on Hughes's right side, right? Like, I think that's something you have to be mindful of, given how powerful a tool that is now in Vancouver's quiver at the top of the line.
Yeah, that's an interesting name to watch for sure. Again, that was, I believe, general manager in San Jose, Mike Greer, confirmed either yesterday or the day before, I don't know, that they would not be qualifying restricted free agent Kalen Addison. And then, as I was saying, unrestricted free agency opens up at 9 a.m. our time on Monday. We'll be on the air. Special three-hour edition starting right at 9. So hopefully Twitter doesn't go down this year like it did last year on July 1st, and we're able to actually get the updates.
I forgot about that. Oh, what a disaster.
I hated that so much. I was so shook.
And I was in Nashville.
It's like the one day where literally my job is to take information from Twitter and relay it to the listeners in rapid fashion. And it's like, nope, can't do that. Just guess at what's happening out there. So hopefully that doesn't happen again.
Remember when Amazon Web Systems went down a couple years ago and like half the world runs on Amazon?
I do not.
Everything
that,
shut
actually.
Down.
I remember when Rogers went down a couple years ago.
That was at the draft.
Not to bring that up, but yeah, that was at the draft. I remember that really clearly when we were trying to broadcast the draft. It'll never happen again, though. Don't worry, guys. Anyways, we'll be on from 9 to noon on Monday for the opening of free agency here on Canucks Talk. All right, in terms of signings and moves around the NHL and how they might relate to the Vancouver Canucks, one right shot defenseman, not that he would necessarily would have been a Canucks target, but I just think it's interesting to keep tabs on this market in general. One right shot defenseman off the open market will not become an unrestricted free agent on Monday. Dylan DeMello, staying in Winnipeg, signs a four-year deal worth $4.9 million a season. And it feels like a fair contract for Dylan DeMello, but I also think he was somebody that people might have been looking at and like, oh, can we get a bargain on Dylan DeMello? And I think this just kind of reemphasizes it's going to be very difficult to find true bargain options on the blue line.
The bargain options, like, take the guy you've heard of out of your bargain option consideration. You know what I mean? Like, the bargain guys are now, don't remove them entirely. They might be bargains in mid-July or early August, but they're not going to be bargains on day one. DeMello, for me, is an interesting name from a Canucks perspective because Vancouver has negotiations with a couple of relatively comparable players. And you know who the most comparable is? It's Tyler Myers.
Mm.
And now, Tyler Myers is 4 years older, obviously significantly bigger. I think there's a massive gap in terms of play style, right? DeMello is a true low event shutdown guy, whereas Myers a little more chaotic, a little more dynamic offensively. But in particular, the reason that I'd group them together is their production. You can fact check me. If you'll fact check me while I talk, Jamie, I'd actually appreciate it. I think DeMello had 31 points this year.
Correct.
And I think Myers had 1 point or 2 points fewer.
29.
Yep. So there, and go look at the defensemen on the open market who are right-handed. It's like, that's like, 2 and 3, it might be 1 and 2 among the unrestricted free agent righties. Putting up 30 points as a defender, you know, who put regularly into a shutdown role, certainly Myers was against McDavid in the playoffs. That's big production. Like, that's so. I think more than anything, my gut reaction to this is, although Myers is older and probably can't demand the same level of term, 4 years might be a little much for a 34-year-old, the number you're probably looking at for a player, if the Canucks were to pay market price for Myers, is probably north of $4 million.
Yep.
Honestly, like, I don't think there's a big gap between Myers and DeMello in terms of minutes played, counting stats, role, physical attributes, although Myers is taller and more physical, right? Like that, those are edges in Myers' favor. And then the age factor. And I would probably suggest to you, too, that DeMelo probably left some money on the table to re-sign in Winnipeg. Maybe Winnipeg had to pay the Trap You Here premium, but kind of doesn't seem like that, right? Like, if you're paying the Trap You Here premium, those deals don't tend to get done now. They tend to get done on, you know, June 30th. So, yeah, I mean, partly my reaction is, man, can you really extend Zadorov for less than that? And partly my reaction is, man, that might be Myers' money. Like, that might be Myers' market price if he's really intent on signing for market value. And if he is, if he's not, like, what level of discount can you cut him while keeping your foot in the door, right? Because that's sort of what matters. We all know Myers would prefer to stay. I think the team would love to have him. But, you know, there's going to be a certain point at which that doesn't actually make sense for the player, right? Like, you have to get your foot in the door for his preference to play for you, for that to, like, be decisive, to govern his actual financial decision-making.
Yeah, it's one thing to take a cut from, like, 3.75 to 3 in order to stay or something like that, right? It's another thing if you're thinking you could go and sign, you know, a 3-year $4.5 million deal, or even a 2-year $4.5 million deal, something like that, on the open market, which, again, the Dylan DeMelo contract suggests would be a possibility. I do think the Zadorov one is interesting as well. Now, DeMelo's older than Zadorov by a couple of years, I believe, and obviously right shot versus left shot, but he does get the 4 years of term.
He again, also, though, like, doesn't have the, like, wow, that's a massive human being thing, which, you know, I think will inflate, honestly, probably both of their.
Well, if I was Nikita Zadorov and if I was his agent, Dan Milstein, right? So this is almost a $20 million deal, just shy of $20 million. Like, how are you not getting more than that if you're Nikita Zadorov?
Especially because if you look at his, like, career goals rate, you know, DeMelo scored more points than Zadorov did last year, but Zadorov had the point explosion in the playoffs, and, you know, he's got like a 16 goal season on his resume. Like, you know, I wouldn't take the fact that my client. If you're repping Zadorov, you're not taking it on, you're not taking the fact that Zadorov produced less last season as, like, a reason why DeMelo should make more, given that Zadorov's offensive track record is, you know, comparable or better.
Yeah. So if I was Nikita Zadorov, that's what I would be looking at. Now, we've heard that Zadorov is willing to be patient, right? And we've heard that with Dakota Joshua. We've obviously heard that with Tyler Myers. So it's not, therefore, a slam dunk that, okay, if he can make more than Dylan DeMelo, that's going to price him out of the Canucks' range, and therefore he's going to be gone. I think the door is still open, but it's just, and look, Jim Rutherford said this to Ian McIntyre last week, right? At this point, a lot of this is up to the players. I think the players kind of know roughly what the Canucks are willing to do, and they're going to have to decide how much are they willing to leave on the table to stay in a situation that they really like. And ultimately, there's only so much the Canucks can do once it gets to that point. And it kind of feels like we're starting to get to that point with guys like Myers, Zadorov, Joshua, maybe even more down the list for the Canucks.
Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, it's a really interesting time. And really, you know, last I'd heard, I think the Canucks thought it was going to be tough to keep a variety of their UFAs. You know, I think the Myers-Bluger ones are the ones that are most interesting to me, but I still think they'd love to keep both Zadorov and Joshua, and yet I think the market prices for those players are going to get so significant, are going to be so silly. And I don't mean silly in that, like, that's not a shot at the players, right? Like, I silly in a good way for those guys.
Yes.
But you know, prohibitive from a Canucks perspective. I think that's why the organization has a recognition internally of just how hard it's going to be to keep those dudes.
And then that brings us to the question of, okay, if it is going to be that difficult and the prices are going to get that high and that potentially silly, as you say.
Maybe cumbersome is a better word.
No, I get what you mean. Surprising, Like, yeah. I think we're all on July 1st. We can prep ourselves for it, and we can kind of, okay, we know the cap is going up. We can see some of these deals getting signed, but I think there is going to be just a general sense of sticker shock still kind of league-wide, and certainly from fans league-wide, on some of the deals, not just Canucks-specific, but just the deals in general. Like, we're going to have to acclimate ourselves to a new salary cap world and a new salary structure world around the NHL on July 1st. And this is part of what we're talking about with the Canucks free agents. But then the next conversation is, all right, if they're not able to keep these players and prices around the league generally are going to be very high, what is their next best strategy for not just filling out the roster, but trying to improve? And of course, this is part of the Jake Guentzel conversation. We're hearing from Elliot Friedman that he's doubting a little bit that the Canucks are going to be able to pull it off. I know Rick Dhaliwal said, look, they're not out, but there's going to be tons of teams that are willing to do these cap gymnastics to go after Jake Guentzel. So it's sounding like it's a bit of a long shot, which is no surprise. We talked on the show yesterday about how just inherently difficult it is to sign a really high-profile UFA like Jake Guentzel. The thing that concerns me, and this is echoing a little bit of what I said yesterday, is if you strike out on Guentzel and prices are shooting up for everyone else around the league, it's going to be really, really tempting to make a mistake on a Tyler Toffoli, to make a mistake on a Jake DeBrusk, to make a mistake on a Chandler Stephenson, which I think could be really, really damaging. But then you also have to figure out a way to improve this team, to add the skill you need on the wings. It's going to be tough. I'm not saying they can't do it. Like, they're very resourceful. They've found ways to improve the team in surprising ways before, but I'm just fascinated to see ultimately what the solution they choose is. And the more I think about it, the more I think they should really be willing to put some premium assets on the trade market. If you can go get somebody who's already under contract, who you don't need to sign to a pretty outrageous deal on July 1st, and who helps a key need on your team, it might make sense to put something like a Lekkerimäki or Villander on the table for the right player in that situation.
Yeah, although they were completely unwilling to do it at the deadline. So I remain skeptical, given their posture then, of their willingness to do it now.
But was that they wouldn't do it for anything, or they wouldn't do it for a rental, right? Because it's different
guys,
at the deadline.
I think having gauged the market, they were definitely not willing to do it, period.
Okay.
I mean, that's what I was reporting at the time, that those guys were seen internally as untouchable. And, you know, that matches what we saw at the deadline market. It's not like any Villander caliber prospect moved, right?
Nope.
I mean, even think about the Guentzel deal to Carolina, right? It was an inferior caliber of prospect than a Villander type piece. So, you know, I mean, we'll see. I'm just skeptical about it because I think this team knows that they're going to need affordable labor, right? Like, I think this club is looking at your Baines and Podkolzin caliber mm-hmm. guys and your Hoglander caliber guys and counting on them to be the players that step up for this team. That's the model that Gentile was talking about Rutherford, you know, erecting in Pittsburgh effectively, right? Where you have, you know, the Mark Donk of it all. And I sort of think about it and think that 2025 first is the one that I'd bet is burning a hole in their pocket.
It makes sense,
right?
And I have no problem with that, frankly. The Hoglander one is interesting because you see his name come up a lot, right? Understandably, fans don't want to move on from Villander or Lekkerimäki or even necessarily the 2025 first. And you're kind of looking at, okay, what could another plausible asset be to get you something really good back in return? And you look at Nils Hoglander, and he's young and he's coming off this great 5-on-5 goal scoring season. And you can understand how he'd be an interesting asset. But the problem is, what, he's got one more year left this year at just over $1 million. They need him to be a productive player for them on the cheap, right? Like, I can understand, I'm not saying he's untouchable, but it's just, as you said, they need affordable labor. And right now, going into next season, Nils Hoglander is the best bet to be a very cheap but also good contributor at forward for this team. So if you trade him, I mean, you better be getting something really, really good back in return, because otherwise you're losing one of those instant sources of cheap labor you have.
Yeah, really good and really cost controlled.
Yeah.
I mean, no, this team's got a lot of work to do. There's no question about it. And it starts with the big ticket items. It starts with the Guentzel ticket items, but you know, there's a lot of work to do outside of that. I mean, I think even if you keep Hoglander, you're probably going to need multiple top nine guys, one of whom's a star level contributor. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's without mentioning the two additional defensemen and the backup goalie and on and on.
No doubt, it's a lot to do.
And, at least another bottom six center.
Yeah, probably.
Because it might be Bluger, but yeah. Like you need to get that done.
650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Somebody texted in, would 2 years and $8 million work for Tyler Myers? I mean, I think that would probably keep him in Vancouver if you were willing to do that. $4 million per over two seasons. I think the Canucks would like that number to be lower, right? Like you'd like him to take a bigger pay cut than that. We'll see. I mean, I know Rick Dhaliwal has said there's still work to be done on that deal. But yeah, I think if they were willing to go there, they'd get it done. But then I start to wonder, if you're willing to go to $4 million AAV for Tyler Myers, do you just kind of bite the bullet and pony up for what Zadorov is asking at that point? Like as Myers' number gets closer to Zadorov, it makes more and more sense to then just go sign Zadorov rather than keep Tyler Myers.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think the other thing to be aware of is the, you know, there's a way of doing a deal too. Like if you're, are you better off doing Myers at 2x4, or are you better off biting the bullet on longer term and managing the AAV, especially if it's a collaborative, you know, negotiation?
If it's like 3x3.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's more total money.
Yeah. Right? I would do that.
3x3 or 4x2, you get an extra $1 million to help out the team, right? Like that's, so there's all sorts of different factors to consider in those conversations. And I just think it comes down to, most of these come down to, how much, right, does a player want to stay, and how close to their market value are you?
Yeah.
Right. And that's like a hard thing for both sides to work through. And it's been sort of the primary dynamic. I think the Canucks have a sense that they're an attractive destination. And I think they have a sense that they're an attractive destination for a variety of their pending unrestricted free agents, who nonetheless are looking at super robust markets on July 1 and, you know, finding that middle ground over the next 5 days. There's been a lot of legwork put in, and it seems like neither side has closed the door. You know, the Myers one stands out to me a little bit more than the Joshua Zadorov ones, because I do think the team feels like that's going to be hard. Like, I do think the team feels like that's going to be, like, they've maybe gone as far as they can go. But I do think the Myers one exists in a different realm. Mm-hmm. And potentially a different, more cooperative realm.
Yeah.
Where, you know, that sort of conversation, like, well, 4x2 is good, but would you do 3x3? Because best for you. And saves us $1 million and helps us improve this team further.
By the way, somebody texted in, I was making a reference earlier, if they miss out on Guentzel, I get concerned about them making that mistake in that second layer of forwards, and I included Tyler Toffoli, and somebody texted in, signing Toffoli would not be a mistake. Inherently, no. Like, I agree,
he's a good player.
I really like the player, and of course he could help this team. I agree, there's a price point where it makes sense. My concern is just that it exceeds potentially by a lot the price point where it makes sense. And you could say the same thing about Chandler Stephenson, Jake DeBrusk, everyone on that. Like, that's inherent with free agency, right? That's inherent in a hard cap situation. If a team signs a player to a deal I don't like on July 1st, it's not necessarily because I think the player is bad. It's just the nuts and bolts of the contract which determines it. So that's my concern. It's not that Tyler Toffoli wouldn't help this team on the ice. He absolutely would. It's my concern about giving potentially term and the amount of money it would require to win the bidding to a player of Tyler Toffoli's age with his foot speed and all of that, right? That would be the concern more than just adding him to the team. Now, somebody else says Tyler Toffoli has Louis Erickson written all over it. Somebody else earlier said Jake Guentzel had Louis Erickson written all over it, which I completely disagree with. Jake Guentzel, totally different class of player than Louis Erickson. But look, I get, Canucks fans still have some scar tissue left over from the Louis Erickson free agent extravaganza from way back in 2016.
I thought of Erickson as a top of the lineup caliber player.
Yeah, I think Guentzel is better though.
Oh, of course, but yeah. I'm just saying,
Louis Erickson was good.
His two way impact had been reliable. His shooting was unsustainable. Yeah, I don't know. Unrestricted free agency is not good.
It's really tough. It's really tough to build your team in a significant way, anything other than like really specific targeted ads.
Experienced general managers will tell you July 1 is their least favorite day of the year. Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm becoming so skeptical when we were talking about it earlier, right? With Detroit and what Stevie Y is doing. Like, it's just a lot of dips into free agency, and that's a tough way to go about building a team.
Yes, it is.
It's a really tough way to sustainably build a team.
It's the least efficient way of acquiring talent.
Yeah. And so it's not that you can't find good deals. We saw the Canucks do it really successfully last year, right? I think you just have to be really, really disciplined, really smart, and also really realistic about the types of players you're going to add, right? Because what the Canucks did last summer, it wasn't top of the lineup players, it was raising the floor. And I think it's a lot easier to do that in free agency than it is to go add that home run ad. Now, I understand I'm out here advocating for Jake Guentzel too. I think you kind of get to a different class of player with Jake Guentzel where they're so good that it makes sense to break the bank. But again, it's that middle tier where the guys like Jake DeBrusk, Tyler Toffoli, et cetera, live that they can work out. I'm not saying they're inherently going to be a mistake for whatever team ends up signing those guys, but you just have to be so, so careful that you don't do something that's going to hamper you down the road and that you're going to regret as a team. We will see in less than a week what the Canucks do on July 1st this year. We will be back tomorrow, a crossover edition of the show tomorrow. We'll set up the Canucks offseason with Donnie and Dolly on the show. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.